Hi everybody, thank you for coming back to the Urban Astronomer Podcast. My name is Alan Fatswelt and I am really sorry for not bringing you an episode last week. Life is tough, but we're back on track, and I used the time to record some interviews with a slightly higher level of guest. I'm rather proud of this last one, and I don't want to spoil the surprise, but I will say this. She has her own Wikipedia page that even she didn't know about, and she has a senior role in one of the most famous robotic space missions of our generation. I've been dropping hints about this all the past week on Twitter, which you would know if you followed me. My handle is @uastronomer, just in case you'd like to join that exclusive group of people who are in the loop, know what's going on. And speaking of being part of inside crowds, my Patreon page. Guys, this is embarrassing, but I don't think I have a single patron. Now, I'm not trying to guilt anybody here, because I totally get the social contracts on the internet. This is how it works. Podcasts like blog posts and Facebook rants, well, they're free. I could stick these recordings behind a paywall if I really wanted to. I know how to do it, but that would be stupid because, well, A, I care more about reaching an audience than I do about the money, and B, I'm honest enough to admit that while plenty of people like the show, there are several zillion other shows that you could quite easily switch to if this one suddenly started demanding too much. So no, my real problem is simply that this podcast is young and still has quite a small audience. I suspect that the percentage of people using any free resource online who want to pay money anyway, even though they don't have to, is very, very low. Let's be ultra conservative here and say that maybe 1 in 1,000 people are both wealthy and generous enough to want to splash money at other people who are rich and comfortable enough to be able to record decent quality online content. That means I would need at least 1,000 listeners before I can expect even my first patron, and we're simply not there. Doesn't explain why my own mother hasn't signed up. Mom, come on. But anyway, we've discussed the problem. Now, I would like your help in solving it. Get me more listeners. If you visit the podcast page at www.urban-astronomer.com and click the podcast link on the menu at the top, you'll be able to browse through all of the episodes. If you find the one that was your favorite so far, click on it and then use the share icons to send it to your friends and family. That would be super helpful. And if you're listening to this through a major distributor like Apple Podcast or Stitcher or Blueberry or any of those, then please could you take the time to leave a review or even just click on the star or the like button or you know whatever that network uses to show your approval. Just these small things will make a huge difference and they'll make me very, very happy. A few episodes ago, I used the podcast to help promote an open day at the UNISA College of Science and Technology in Roodepoort. That segment was recorded at the UNISA Observatory in Sunnyside, Pretoria, where I had completed an astronomy practical course a few years back as part of my studies. You're about to hear the rest of that interview, in which I asked Patricia Skelton, one of my former teachers, about astronomy and academia, the importance of South Africa in the world of astronomy, and how best you prepare for a career in astronomy.
So I'm Patricia Skelton, and I am currently employed as a lecturer in astronomy in the Department of Mathematical Sciences at UNISA.
Okay, and how did you end up here? I mean, looking way back, education-wise, what got you into astronomy and working in astronomy?
Well, I can certainly say that if you go back and interviewed my matriculating self and asked me where I was going to find myself, astronomy probably wasn't at the top of the list at that point.
Right.
In actual fact, rather bizarrely, I was going to become a pilot, which was...
Yeah,
which is a bit strange.
What, commercial or...?
I had applied with... South African Airways. They have a cadet pilot training program, and I saw an advert in the newspaper and I thought, I like planes.
Yeah,
that sounds quite exciting. So I sort of ventured down that path, but that didn't turn out at the end of the whole process. And of course, you know, by that stage I'd already been out of matric for a year, and then it was already well into, I think we were in about February, March of the following year, which meant going to a residential university by that point was too late.
Yeah.
And I happened to remember, it was actually my father who said to me, oh, did you know you can study astronomy at UNISA and the registration is still open?
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting because I'd enjoyed astronomy, but I was really introduced to it from the space exploration aspect, especially by my father. He's been a heavy influence in that regard. My fondest memory is actually of him showing me the slides that he had purchased when he was in America of the Voyager images of Jupiter and that as they came out. And we still have those slides at home somewhere.
Mm.
And it was one of the things on a Saturday night, he'd whip out the slide projector and he'd put all these images in. And it was absolutely fantastic because he was so excited and passionate about it. And there I was sitting, looking at these images of the planets. And these were the new ones that had just, they had come in and everything. And so when he said, you can do astronomy, I read the description. I thought, yeah, okay. I think this is for me. And as I say, because UNISA's registrations were still open, I signed up and I haven't left. I've been here now since 2003. That's when I started as a student. Yeah.
Okay.
And now I'm teaching in the department. So that's been quite nice, actually, that I've been able to get onto a career path so early on, particularly in astronomy.
Mm-hmm.
It's not usual to find someone at the time as well. When I was employed, I only had a master's when I got permanent employment.
Mm-hmm.
And typically, especially in the astronomy field, you normally would need to go up to a doctoral mm-hmm. by that point. But I was lucky enough that a position became available. So I sort of slotted straight in because I'd been through the coursework.
Right.
So it worked out really nicely that I could come in and start teaching the very courses that I'd been through.
Right, yeah.
And I used my experiences to help reshape the courses a little bit because obviously I'd been through it as a distance student.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay, we need to improve this. Or no, this is great. And came up with some new ideas.
Mm.
And yeah, as I said, I've been here ever since.
So how long have you been teaching then?
I started as a full-time lecturer back in, now I have to do some math for you, this will be 2010. That was when I became a full-time permanent employee. Okay. But in 2008, I was employed as a postgraduate student assistant.
Right.
So I sort of came in at that point and basically marked assignments and assisted with viewing evenings and helped out at the practical. But in 2010, that was when I could apply for full-time employment because I'd got my master's.
Yeah.
So then I came on as a junior lecturer.
Okay.
And now I'm up to the lecturer level. So I'm slowly making my way my way through.
So what comes next?
So the next will be the senior lecturer level, but for that you do need a PhD.
Right.
So that's what I'm currently focusing all my attention on at the moment.
What's it about, your PhD?
So my doctoral research is actually a continuation of something I started at an honors level.
Okay.
As part of the honors degree here at UNISA, you can do two research projects.
Right.
And so for the first year, I opted to do a little literature review on how exoplanets were detected. Because I thought that was quite fascinating. You know, this was prior to Kepler with its thousands of exoplanet candidates. And I just wanted to learn more about it. But then in the second year was sort of, okay, let's do something different now.
Mm-hmm.
And so then that's when the subject was proposed, and it was looking at a class of binary stars called W Ursae Majoris type variable stars.
Right.
Or, if you don't want the full name, basically eclipsing contact binary stars.
Okay, yes.
So mostly people are familiar with binary stars in the sense of a detached binary system. So where you have two stars orbiting, this common center of mass, but pretty much don't influence each other's lives. You know, they'll live their own lives and not really make too much of an influence on the other. You can then get where they're a little bit closer now, and then you can get to this type of binary, which we call a semi-detached binary, where they're a bit closer that what happens is the one star is actually distorted from being a spherical shape. It actually ends up looking like a teardrop.
Okay.
And what happens is that it can transfer material onto its component.
Right.
So that's the second time. Then now we push the extreme now where we reach the contact where the stars are so close to each other that they're actually in physical contact.
Right.
So to try and get an idea of what they look like, I normally say to people, if you know what a ground nut looks like when it's in its shell.
Right, yeah.
Just to kind of get an idea, so you've got these two stars, but they're actually surrounded by a common envelope of material.
If so, I can step away from interviewing, what keeps them from collapsing into each other then? What keeps them apart?
It's all the conservational. So what we do know
is... But I mean,
isn't
there drag with the...
What does happen is that they... One of the fascinating things about them is that we've seen them. We see that, you know, we've detected them. We're not sure how they form, and we don't know what they evolve into.
Okay.
So the idea is that the leading suspicion is that they will merge, but it's going to take a very long time. It's a slow process.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting because we haven't seen any systems where we would say, oh, this is sort of end stage evolution for them.
Yeah.
What we do know with them is that if they have something called a period cutoff limit. So basically, if you look at the sample that we have, we can detect a whole number of these systems with orbital periods up to a specific limit.
Mm-hmm.
We don't see any systems beyond that.
As in shorter than that?
Yeah.
Okay.
So the question obviously is, okay, what is happening at that point that we're not seeing any, you know, systems with a shorter orbital period?
Mm.
Now, I say period cutoff limit, but obviously as the, telescopes have improved and we've got far more sensitive equipment,
mm-hmm.
people have pushed that cutoff limit, you know, just a little bit each and every time.
Right.
But the point is that it does drop off. There's a point where you're just not seeing anything.
Yes.
And that is obviously a big area of research because now we're saying, oh, is this the sort of point where a merger is going to occur?
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things what we think might happen is that there are some stars that rotate very rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
So they're single stars, but they're rotating extremely rapidly. We're not entirely sure, you know, how that's happened.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is that maybe those stars are actually the results of mergers of the two stars in a contact binary.
Okay, yes, yeah.
But you've got to be able to, you know, complete that story from the cutoff limit to these rapidly rotating single stars. And we're not seeing that.
Uh-huh.
That's not to say it doesn't happen, but...
Maybe it's probably quick enough that's... You're just not catching any at the right time.
And so we don't actually know. So there is this little gap that we are seeing in understanding these systems. And it's the same when it comes to their formation because we suspect they probably did start off as being a detached system. So, you know, two stars were, you know, not really that close, but either due to there being a third or fourth member in the system, that sort of started the spiral in resulting in this contact binary formation.
Yeah.
So one way that we can try and figure out what the likely formation scenario for a contact binary is to look at what's happening to its orbital period.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as you pointed out, the orbital period can change. So if you monitor the system long enough, you can detect if the orbital period is changing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you see a sinusoidal behavior to this change, you can infer that it's due to the presence of a third or more bodies in the system. So for the majority of the known contact binaries where we're seeing a period change, it's because of the presence of a third or fourth star in the system.
Right.
And so that kind of pushes you in the direction, okay, maybe this is how all contact binaries form.
Mm-hmm.
But having said that, there's still that small percentage where, you know, you're monitoring them and there's nothing happening to the period. Or if there is something, it's not due to a third or fourth body. So it could be due to, as you said, you can lose mass from the system depending on... there's a factor that we call the full factor. Mm. I like to call it a measure of the puffiness of the system.
Okay, yeah.
So it's bound between two limits. So you have what we call when they're just in contact, or when their fill out is at where we say 0%. That's like the absolute minimum for contact.
Mm-hmm.
And if you remember with the semi-detached, I said, you know, the star is distorted into a tear shape.
Yeah.
Well, both stars are distorted into a tear shape in the contact. So when you're at 0%, the point where they're joined, that neck point is really, really thin. It's like, you know, just mm-hmm. in contact. But as they fill out, so as that fill out factor increases, so you can imagine that neck thickness increases.
Right, yeah.
And the stars, I'd like to call that, get puffier as you go out.
Okay, yeah.
And if they reach 100%, uh-huh. Then they can start losing mass outside the system, because then it's not going to be contained within the system by either star gravitationally.
Yeah.
It's going to be lost. If you start losing mass in that way, then you can also cause a orbital period to change in the system, again, from all the conservation laws.
Okay.
So if you're having mass transferred out, there has to be a change in the, you know, this orbital period of the system.
Yes, yeah.
And you know, they're already fascinating from that point. But then it's complicated by the fact that you don't just get one type of the star.
Mm-hmm.
There are two subtypes
mm-hmm.
that everyone normally talks about. You have what we call the A type and the W type.
Okay.
And in the A type system, what you would find is if you have a larger component and a smaller component. So if you think that one star is bigger than the other one,
mm-hmm.
the larger component has the higher temperature. Which makes sense, you know, the bigger star that should have the higher temperature. In the W-type system, it's reversed. The smaller star has the higher temperature.
So it's probably lost a lot of material to the other one? Or?
So therein comes the idea of whether it's an evolutionary sequence, that you can start off at A-type, but you've got material being transferred, that eventually what was the bigger one...
Yeah.
You know, but that's also complicated things, because why are there two types?
Right.
And I say there are only two subtypes. There are actually probably four or five, but the ones that are most common are the A and W.
Right.
So it's extremely challenging, because there's so many facets that you can look at in terms of the system, and there's a lot we don't know about them. I often think we probably know more about neutron stars and black holes than we might know about these contact binary systems.
Yeah.
Because they are difficult to try and, you know, figure out. And, you know, the sample size has increased enormously over the last couple of years thanks to automated sky surveys.
Yes.
So before that, we had a sample, but they, you know, it wasn't all that large. And as soon as we had this automated sky surveys running, and actually combined with work done by amateur observers, that has certainly boosted the sample size as well as the database size for all of these stars. I often tell people that, you know, I can just get data. I just have to log on, go online and get data for this now, which is fantastic. But if you went back 20 years, you'd have to consult, you know.
Uh-huh.
A book,
yeah.
and actually have to go through doing everything yourself. But now the surveys have taken care of that, which is fantastic.
Yeah. So we were talking about your research, and I managed to completely lose track because we started talking about reviewing on exoplanets, but we then moved onto the contact variables. Is that what you're studying? That's your...
Yes. So that I started at the honors level, I've stuck with all the way through. So my master's was on it and my PhD's on it.
Okay.
So what I'm interested in, the fact that we have contact binaries that we would call active binaries.
Okay.
So these, for example, are ones where the period is changing
uh-huh.
or ones where their light curves display additional behavior to them, which may be due to spots being present on the surface.
Okay, all right.
And one of the oddities about these is that, for example, we know our sun is magnetically active.
Mm.
And the sun takes, what, about 29 days to do one rotation, I think, on its axis.
Yeah, whichever part you look at, yeah.
But these stars are completing, you know, the spin periods of about 8 hours. Okay. So somewhere between 8 and 24 hours.
Right.
So, you know, they're rapidly rotating stars, but there are no spots. We're not seeing evidence of magnetic activity, which is weird because we would expect it to be.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the theories is that because you've got two stars that are sharing this common envelope of material, we think that this common envelope suppresses the dynamo effect. So we're not seeing spots, you know, coming up to the surface. However, having said that, there's a portion of the sample set that display characteristics which we would attribute to magnetic activity. So the question that comes up is, why are we seeing it in some systems but not in others?
Right.
And so I'm interested in looking at these active systems to try and see if there's anything about them that sets them apart from the other systems. You know, is there a particular physical parameter or something of these systems that make them more active than others?
Right, right.
So I'm looking at their data to identify active systems. So this is, you know, doing an analysis of the orbital period.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like you look at it and say, okay, you know, your orbital period is stable. I'm not interested in you.
Mm-hmm.
And then moving on to the next one and trying to find them. And sometimes, you know, the orbital period might be changing, but then their light curve is pretty stable. I'm not seeing any changes in the light curve, but it's still interesting because the period's changing.
Yeah.
Then there might be a system where the period is not changing, but the light curve is displaying kind of weird effects. And one of the effects that you can often see in it is, so we have in one complete orbital cycle, there'll be two minima.
Mm-hmm.
So in your mind, you can think that there'll be two eclipses as star one passes star two and then star two in front of star one.
Yeah.
Okay, so you'll have two minima, but then you'll also have two maxima. So when both are presenting side on to the observer.
Yeah.
So that's when there should be maximum light coming up because they're presented sideways on and they're not eclipsing each other. So you would expect that therefore when they're at maximum, the light curve, the magnitude should be the same at maximum. Yeah. There are sometimes in some systems, one maximum is higher than the other one. And this is what we call the O'Connell effect.
Okay.
So the question is why is one higher than the other? And added on to that is that that effect is not always permanent. So it can be there for a couple of days, maybe a few weeks or sometimes a few seasons or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And then all of a sudden the system will return to normal.
Is O'Connell the person who noticed this or who figured it out?
It was named after the person who noticed this.
Right.
So the proposal to explain this was that it had to be spots forming on the surface.
Okay.
And now one of the things it becomes very tricky is you can in principle model these systems with stellar spots.
Yeah.
So you can put spots on the surface to try and explain it. The problem is that if we think of the sun, so when we're seeing sunspots on the sun, they're very small compared to the size of the sun.
Yeah, I'm thinking with that, you kind of have to tune your model to fit your observation, and that doesn't really tell you if the model's right.
Yes, and so what you have to do is if you're going to put a spot on, it is very risky because any combination of spot parameters can reproduce the same effect. So basically what you're doing is you're throwing a spot model on and it's a possible model. It could be one of 10, 20, 30, 40.
You're just speculating in one that...
So the thing is it's very difficult. And one of the oddities about it is sometimes the spots can cover something like 20 to 30% of one of the star's surface. So now, to mind, you think with that, it doesn't gel with what we know with the sun, because the sunspots just cover a very small percent. I mean, you don't never see a spot that's covering 40 or 50% of the sun surface.
Yeah, to make a spot that big,
well,
I mean.
You see, this is where the problem comes in, because one big one can be replaced by two smaller ones of maybe much lower temperature or something like that.
Yeah.
So using the spot model is very risky. But it is in some cases the only way you can fit to the observed light curve. And, you know, you did point out that you are fitting to what you're seeing. And so what you want to do is, as much as possible, is know that the other parameters that you're setting are true for the system. So they're not where you're playing around with too many guesses, that these are real values.
Yeah.
And so one way, the best way to do that is actually to get spectroscopic data for the systems. Because if you can get spectroscopic data, you can set, and we don't work with the individual masses of the star, we work with the mass ratio.
Okay.
But you can get that from the spectroscopic observations. You can pull out a mass ratio. And once you've set that, that's a big parameter to have set. If you can set the mass ratio and you can set the temperatures, considering the number of parameters we have to play around with, having that amount of data, you know, significantly reduces the others where the guesswork comes in. And so I typically avoid using the spot model as much as possible because of the risks associated with it.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a standard that's pointed out in many papers where the opening line will be, we know that it's not right to do this, but we found if we invoke this spot model, it produces the best fit to the light curve. But it's just one example because we know it's very risky to do so.
I suppose you probably don't have much interest as at an amateur level then. Do you have a telescope at home?
Myself, no. This is always one of the weird things is that people do ask me, say, you must have a telescope at home and you must be going out. And I actually don't. And I don't have a telescope, personal one, although I do have access to lots of lovely ones inside the observatory that I can use. But no, when I do take the telescope, I'll maybe take it home on the odd occasion to, you know, to have a look at something. Although from where I'm living, it does sort of limit what I can really enjoy from such a light polluted area. But you know, it is nice. If I know I'm going on holiday somewhere with very dark skies, and if I can take a scope with it, it's still amazing. Although I often first get lost just by going out because, you know, if you're in a true dark sky environment and you just have that sea of stars coming over, you have no idea where you're looking and you're just relying solely on this piece of technology because it's just, it still leaves me breathless when you when you look up at that. And I do enjoy it.
One of the things I like to try and do, or the reasons I do this whole thing, is because I think that in this country we have a bit of an inferiority complex where anything high-tech or intellectual or scientific goes. We've got all these great facilities here. We've got SALT. We're building half of SKA and so on. And people just, you know, it's they might know what SKA is because they've seen it mentioned in the news. What do you think really have we got that we should be proud of?
That's a very interesting point you've raised because it's one of the things that I think particularly in the scientific community we have to fight with on a daily basis is precisely that, because I do think we get looked upon as not being capable of doing leading research.
Well, I saw some horrible comments back when the race was still on between us and Australia, who's going to get SKA. And you read a press release that, no, we're definitely on the shortlist, and there's 19 comments saying this is nonsense, just for development purposes. No, that's not it at all. We're not doing it to give poor people houses. We're doing it because we can do great research.
I think that's very true. And one of the things we do struggle with is the question always comes down to, why must we give you X number of billions of rands to build a telescope, but we can, whereas if we, you know, divert it somewhere else, we can fix all of these other problems or something. And it's very hard. We're not the only ones who face that question. For example, NASA has that problem on an annual basis, having to defend why they should be given money from, you know, Congress and that. But, and I think maybe it also has to do with we don't really And maybe it's a fault of the professionals or something, but we don't really share what can come out from investing money in a telescope or, for example, in a space program or something. Because the immediate returns are not obvious. Because as you say, someone's saying, but I'm not seeing a house being built.
Right.
But what happens, and this is what people don't realize, is that the technology that has to be developed, the skill set that has to be learned, the software that needs to be written, all of these kinds of things can have a positive influence, not necessarily immediately, but certainly down down the line. A classic example is the fact that we, almost all of us now have a camera in our smartphone. But as I'm sure you know, the whole point of a CCD camera was for imaging in astronomy. No one at the time would have ever thought that we would, that CCD that was built for that would end up in your smartphone.
Yeah, in nightclubs taking selfies.
Yes. And it's the same with everything, is that, you know, you're learning a lot when you're doing these kinds of designs. And it really does push things to the edge, because we've got to take a lot into consideration when we're building these things as well. And you need a labor force. You need skilled technicians who are going to be running these things. So in the end, there is that impact. But I think the problem comes in because people expect the impact to happen now.
Right.
And they don't realize that it's going to happen, but it'll happen a few years down the line. But there is going to be something positive coming from it. And tying into that, again, is that I don't think science, particularly in South Africa, gets the recognition and the publicity that it should be getting. Because we certainly have many researchers conducting world-class research. But unless you are reading the astronomy journals or you're registered on one of the professional mailing lists, you are not aware of the work that's going on. And to that extent, I do understand when people say, but what is it you're actually doing? You've built SALT, but what are you doing? Oh, you've won the SKA, but what are you doing? And it's a valid question that they're asking. And I think that is something that we need to address, is that we need to showcase what it is that we do. And we have got some of the best skies. You know, you have people who want to do observations of the galactic center. You know, and a flight to South Africa for some people coming in from Europe is a lot better than having to fly all the way to Australia or to South America or something like that. And, you know, we've got fantastic partnerships with a lot of, you know, countries. And this can be university partnerships or research partnerships and agreements. So, you know, you share the time between a lot of people because they want to use it. And there's only a set number of hours available per year for observing. And it's a highly competitive environment. And I can tell you that from experience, because when I need time in Sutherland, I don't just drive there and rock up and say, I'd like to use a telescope for the evening. You have to apply, because everybody wants time on one of the telescopes on the plateau. So you have to make your science argument really good in the hopes that they will go, okay, you know what? Yes, we'll give you a week of observing time. So it's a very competitive environment, particularly for SALT. SALT, I think, is oversubscribed. They've got just so many people wanting to use it that there's not enough hours in the night, basically, to allow everyone to do that. And because everyone's science is so different as well. And I think that's what's so nice about it, is that the telescopes are not designed just for one thing. So we're able to do lots of different science or types of research on them.
I suppose that's one of the joys of these automated surveys you were talking about earlier. You've got these vast sets of data, enormous amounts of observations, which you no longer have to schedule it. You want to look at that area, we've already got it on file.
And then that's why I found them to be amazing resources, because I don't have to now go and say, okay, goodness, I need to get data on this star, for example, photometric data. let me first go and look in, you know, one of these databases, because if it's there, typically I'm already looking at somewhere between 5 to 10 years worth of photometric data.
Yeah.
Which is fantastic. And many of these surveys are ongoing. They're not going to be shut down anytime soon. Mm-hmm. If anything, more and more are going to be added to it. So for me, it's fantastic because I have a wealth of data lying there. Mm-hmm. Many of the databases are actually available to the public. Okay. So you, in principle, can go in and log in, get data, start doing research, have a look at these things. Mm. You don't have to belong to a professional society. And I think that's what's really great about it, is they've realized that people are interested in these things.
Mm.
You know, sometimes somebody wants to, I want to have a look at the light curve of that star with an exoplanet. You can go and download the data and have a look at it.
Yeah,
and then see if you can repeat the observations from your own backyard, which has been done. I mean, I think a few years back, there was an example of, a teen who discovered an exoplanet using his telescope in his backyard or something.
I saw mention of that, yes.
And I think that's one of the things, what I like about the fact is that astronomy has really changed from being, you know, just associated with men in suits in an observatory. Yeah. And no one else is allowed to do it. To the fact now where I'm happy if, you know, amateurs are going out and they're collecting this data, because they're the ones who are putting the time in and I can use the data in my research. So we always encourage people that if you are interested in doing it, your data can be used.
Yeah.
And it's not that it's going somewhere and lying in a database and no one's looking at it.
Mm.
I consult all databases all the time. So if someone said, oh, you know, I can monitor this for you or whatever, please go ahead and do that, because it helps to fill in the gaps. Because say, for example, maybe one of the automated telescopes is down for engineering.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm losing all of this time on a particular field or a star.
Yeah.
But someone else who might be in a nice environment with a CCD and even better with a filter wheel will be like, I'll take over and have a look at it. So I think that's what I like about the field, where it's changed for the better,
mm-hmm.
is that there's no, and I mean, from personal experience, having chatted to some amateur astronomers, they've always felt that people sort of look down on them, that particularly some professional astronomers would look down on them and saying,
some definitely, yeah,
you know, you don't know what you're doing, so please don't even try talk to me about this.
Yeah.
And I'm of the opinion that, you know, we should not be doing that. We should really be working together, because this is how you make exciting discoveries.
It's definitely a growing idea, this. In fact, I know that the ASTO Symposium next year is the theme of the whole event is professional amateur collaboration.
Yeah, and we should really be doing more of it. Because I, for example, for me, I work as a lecturer.
Mm-hmm.
So I spend my days in the office doing teaching or admin, you know, that kind of thing. And then maybe throw my own research in.
Mm-hmm.
So when I go home, I don't necessarily want to have to go outside, because I'm too tired to then go set up my own equipment and do stuff. So I rely on applying for time or, like you said, databases to get my data. But I know of a couple of people I've spoken to where they can't wait to get out at night and just go and observe to whatever time in the morning. And then they still go into work. So they're like amazing people. And I've chatted with them. I said to him, well, you know, if you've ever wondering about what you could look at or what data you could get, you know, just give me a shout, because I have quite a long list of things that, you know, people could look at.
Yeah.
And and I think one of the nice things as well is that because I know that, you know, the people are now just like discovering objects from their backyard, I'm always encouraging people.
Yeah.
Because you never know what you might find
by
happen chance, pointing your telescope
at
a patch just because you wanted to look at something, and then, oh, supernova or something, you know, because you just don't know.
Yeah.
And one of the things is that sometimes with the, the observatories on site, you know, someone's on target looking at something, and if a supernova goes off, phone calls have to be made to get everyone to point their telescopes in, in the same direction and try and get some data. So I always say that you never know, you might be that one person at home who actually gets first light and is recording something before the professional guys can even get their telescopes pointing at the object. You know.
Brilliant. With all the teaching, sort of like a learner profile, what's the most popular courses that people want to sign up? Is it the practicals or is it the introductory course or?
That is a very interesting question, but it really depends on what the student actually wants to do. And in the sense that if they're interested in pursuing postgraduate studies in astronomy, then they will take all of our astronomy modules. If they're just doing course fillers, then the popular one is definitely the general introduction to astronomy module. That one, I think, is great. We sort of try and encourage everyone who's doing a general BSc. It doesn't have to be in astronomy or anything. But if you really want a good book and a nice introduction,
it's a good course. I really enjoyed that one.
It's a fantastic introduction to the world of astronomy without the math and physics, which is always a big plus for many people. And I think probably the other popular module would be the practical, because I can't remember if you did this particular exercise where we give you data from one of the surveys to determine the distance to the Small Magellanic Cloud using Cepheids. It may have changed from when you were here.
We didn't do that one. No. I remember having to identify the odd one out in an open cluster by plotting the proper motions. But
yeah, so it's one of the changes that we've made, and it uses data from one of these sky surveys. And for me, I like to do it because it gives the students this opportunity to use real data.
Yeah.
To do real research, and I think they really enjoy that aspect of it because they're now realizing they can measure, you know, distances to galaxies and just all from this little data set that they've imported to Excel, kind of thing, and done some wizardry, and you know, all of a sudden, bam, there's a distance. So that, so I think the introduction and the practical are probably the most popular. The modules, but again, as I said, it depends on whether they want to do it. Pursue astronomy all the way through.
If somebody does want to, say high school level, wants to become a professional astronomer, how would you steer them?
So the first and very important piece of advice is, please don't take mathematical literacy. So when it comes to your subject choices, I don't care what anybody says to you, mathematical literacy will not get you admission into the College of Science, Engineering and Technology. Mm-hmm. It will not. Even if you get 100% for it, it's not going to get you in. So I would say if they haven't made their subject choices, please take mathematics and physics.
Mm-hmm.
If they've already made a choice, but it's not too late, please revert back to normal mathematics because you're going to need it. And that really, you do need that strong maths and physics foundation.
Yeah.
When you start your degree. The other piece of advice I normally give to students is that depending on where you want to study, they may not necessarily offer astronomy modules at the undergraduate level. That's not a train smash. And the reason I say that is that there are many students who come into astronomy at the honors level, but have an engineering background or an applied math background.
Right.
So they've never seen or touched an astronomy book before, but somewhere down the line, they've read something, seen something, and now want to switch to astronomy. You can switch at the honors level. And normally what we would then encourage people is to look at, so for example, if someone came to UNISA like that, if they didn't have an astronomy background, then we would either suggest that they could register for our undergraduate modules, but for non-degree purposes. So basically as a brush up, because then you kind of read everything and carry on. Or the alternative is just go and grab a really good book from the library, like, you know, an introduction to astronomy text, just to get them on the right, especially if they don't have any astronomy background. It's just useful for them to have some idea of how everything works, because obviously at an honors level, then you're looking at quantum mechanics and stuff like that. But it helps if you just have that little bit of a general information
background. You're not starting from the ground. You can...
Yeah. Then you kind of appreciate a bit more why it is you're looking at a quantum mechanics course in astronomy at an honors level when you really want to learn about stars. But you kind of have to understand what's going on at that level. And I think my final piece of advice is that astronomy is diverse. It's a very wide field, and you don't have to become a professional astronomer to be in the astronomy field. And the reason I say that is that I'm an astronomer. Uh-huh. I don't build the telescope that I use. I don't write the software that I use. I'm relying on others who've done that. So that is certainly other paths where you can be in astronomy, but you are the instrument designer. You're the telescope engineer.
Okay, yeah.
You're writing the software. And I think what's great about that is that if you're really good at, for example, writing programming and doing coding, but you don't want to become a pure astronomy researcher, you can use your understanding of astronomy to write the software that someone would need.
Well, there's huge demand for that now, getting ready for SKA again.
Precisely. Yeah. And I try to use that, as I say, as a piece of advice, because I think sometimes people think that astronomy, you go, say, undergraduate to PhD, and it's pure research all the way.
Yeah.
But it's not really that. There are a couple of people I know who are in astronomy, but work on telescope design, mirror design, instrumentation. These are all important areas in the field that I rely on, but I'm certainly not going into a factory anytime soon and going to design an instrument. I kind of rely on other people to build it for me, that I can just say, yes, I'd like to use that spectrograph, please.
And I know, coming from the other direction as well, people who study geology go on to become planetary scientists, or or physicists going on to study cosmology, or...
And that's the point, is that you can really come into the field from, as you said, somewhere where no one would have thought of, that you can approach it from some other direction. And so that's why I say you can keep your options open. You don't have to immediately try and make it very narrow and say it's only this way.
Okay.
And if you are interested in doing astronomy all the way through to the doctorate as a researcher, you can either go purely theoretical or purely observational, or a hybrid.
Yeah.
Okay. And I certainly don't need to explain to people either that you've got the entire electromagnetic spectrum to work from.
Yes, yeah.
With a host of objects. So it's not that you're going to be bored anytime soon. But there's certainly more to astronomy than what's normally put out there. Yeah. And I think just for students to keep that in mind, that you can really approach it from any direction.
Okay. All right. I'm out of questions. Is there anything you would like to promote or plug? You've got your science week coming up?
Yes. So we will, the university's science campus in Ruderpoort will be participating in National Science Week next week. We have 2 days open for the general public. The one is on the public holiday, so Wednesday the 9th of August, and the other open day is on the Saturday the 12th of August.
Right.
Both days the campus will be open from 10 a.m. until 3 p.m. and we're going to be showcasing what we do on the campus. So for example, I have a colleague who's going to be doing Lego robotics demonstrations.
Okay.
I will be there with my colleagues, and we'll have some of our astronomy posters up in an exhibition area. And I will be building a comet that day as well. So if anyone's interested in seeing a comet being built, you're more than welcome to pop in. And we'll also have a host of members from the college itself, from the various departments, so computing and engineering, as well as some colleagues from the College of Agricultural and Environmental Sciences. I've been promised there might be a 3D printer on the day, and maybe some drones flying around as well. But if anybody's interested, they're more than welcome to get in touch with me. I've the 2 email addresses they can reach me by, because I'm not always in my office at my telephone, but I'm more often than not, you can always find me checking my emails all the time. So the first is a very easy one that I normally throw out. It's just a general one that does come to my mailbox. Mm-hmm. So it's stars, STARS, at unisa.ac.za.
Right.
So that is, it'll come to a general mailbox, but I do have access to it. And so if I respond, it'll probably then say I'm responding on behalf of that email account, but I do check that one regularly. Mm-hmm. And the second one is my personal email account at the university. So if you'd rather when it send an email to me directly, it's then skeltpl, so skeltpl at unisa.ac.za.
Okay. Okay, well, thank you very much for your time. It's been wonderful.
Yeah, it's been lovely seeing you again after some time.
Last week, I got an email from a listener in Scotland. He says, "Hi, I just listened to episode 14, The Self-Interview. I wanted to say how much I enjoyed it. It was a great interview, and your wife is certainly very good at interviewing. She should be involved more. I've been listening to your podcast, probably since it started, having received it through the 365 Days of Astronomy feed. I don't follow that feed anymore, but I am subscribed directly to yours. I'm a retired IT programmer and latterly manager, but I have an interest in astronomy. I also do a little podcasting. I'm a contributor to Hacker Public Radio and help with administration. The site at hackerpublicradio.org produces 5 shows a week contributed by the community on all manner of subjects from quite technical things to sounds captured during the night in rural Tennessee. Today's show is number 2359. To finish, I hope you don't mind me pointing out a tiny error in the errata section for this episode. You use a stadia when mentioning the length issue you raised. Stadia is the plural of stadium, so you should have written a stadium. Thank you for the podcast. Good luck with it. Best wishes, Dave Morris." Well, that got me thinking. Actually, first of all, I want to say over 2,000 episodes. That's incredible. That got me thinking. I last researched the story of Eratosthenes some years ago for an article I wrote about how we know that the Earth is round, and I vaguely remembered having trouble with that unit of length. While some online resources give a very precise measure of its length, others give a broad range, along with an explanation for how the exact length wasn't known, since it probably was never that strictly defined to begin with. The name of the unit had a similar problem. Some resources referred to it as a stadium, most called it a stadia and referenced an Olympic stadium as the source of the name, and one even called it a stadion, along with a bunch of other antique measurements, and all with the corresponding Greek versions in Greek script. Very confusing, so I just went with the majority voice, giving extra weight to older resources, including one of my favorite texts called The History of Astronomy, written by George Forbes in 1909. I reasoned that the longer ago the source had been written, the more likely it was that the author would have studied the classics, and so it would be more likely to understand classical measures and the language used to express them. Anyway, I replied to Dave, and I said all of this to him to explain why I thought that I was, in fact, right. Well, we've been in contact since then, and I'm pleased to announce that he will be airing an episode of the Urban Astronomer podcast on his own show, Hacker Public Radio, which I've begun listening to myself recently and find it very interesting. I definitely recommend it, and you'll find a link to it on the show notes. If you're not sure about all this cross-pollinating business, well, I'll make it easy for you. I'll be airing one of their episodes on this channel in the next few weeks, just to give you a taste. Something else you'll be hearing a lot of soon is a series of public lectures presented at SCOPEX, South Africa's largest telescope and astronomy expo, which we are holding at the Johannesburg Military History Museum on the 16th of September this year. Now, aside from the usual displays of amateur-built telescopes and star parties and astrophotography competitions, kids' science shows, and so on, there will also be a series of lectures and workshops, and I will be recording all of them. You'll be able to listen to all of them here on the podcast and watch the videos at the Scopex website and on the Astronomical Society of South Africa's YouTube channel. If you'd like some idea of what's coming up, you can visit the Scopex website at www.scopex.com. scopex.co.za. So if you check out the websites, you'll get an idea of exactly what's on the program, who will be speaking and when, as well as a list of sponsors and prizes that can be won on the day. If you're in the area, I'd absolutely hope to see you there. It's not a lot of money to get in. In fact, we don't charge anything. It's just the standard museum entrance fee with discounts for scholars and pensioners. I hope to see you there. But of course, if you can't make it, which I gather that most of my listeners won't, since half of you guys aren't even in South Africa, well, then you'll be able to just listen to the talks here on the show. Plus, hopefully, I might even get a couple ad hoc interviews with telescope makers and some figures in South African astronomy. Right, well, that is all we have time for this week. But before I sign off, here's a quick reminder just to let the people in your life know about the show, help them to find it, leave reviews wherever you can, or even throw a few pennies my way on the Patreon page. And if you'd like to leave a comment or tell me what you think of the show, you can tweet me at youastronomer or mail me at podcast@urban-astronomer.com. Till next week then, cheerio.